From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We would hope he wouldn't have declared the emergency powers he declared. Now that he's made that decision, our hope now is that he hurry back to elections. And at the same time, we want to continue working with him to fight these terrorists and extremists.
President Bush continues supporting Pakistani President General Musharraf as an ally in the so-called war on terror. Since Musharraf imposed a state of emergency 3 days ago in Pakistan, thousands of lawyers, human rights activists, and journalists have been beaten and arrested. We'll go to Lahore to get the latest. Then a new PBS documentary features interviews with victims of extraordinary rendition speaking for the first time on U.S. television.
I was in a lot of pain, and I was sort of counting the seconds, actually just counting 1 second, 2 seconds, just like that, really. Just hoping that it's going to be over soon, it's going to be over soon. And then the aircraft landed, now they're going to take us out of the aircraft, now. They didn't.
The first, though, Guatemalan election results are in. Center-left candidate Alvaro Colom beat hardline general Otto Perez Molina in an upset victory. All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, a massive show of protest to President General Musharraf was met with force yesterday in the third day of emergency rule. Thousands of lawyers, human rights activists, and journalists were tear-gassed, beaten, and arrested for protesting what they describe as nothing short of martial law. At least 2,000 people have been arrested, but the actual number is believed to be far higher. Over 48 hours after the crisis erupted, President Bush made his first public comments following a White House meeting with Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan. Bush urged Musharraf to hold elections, but stressed his importance as a key ally in the so-called war on terror.
Dr. Brissett is also a young man. God willing.
Pakistan has received over $10.5 billion in U.S. aid since 2001. Three-quarters of that funding goes to the military. In Britain, opposition leader Shahbaz Sharif denounced Western support for Musharraf.
They have said they have been deeply disappointed. However, they have not gone beyond that. I think what we expect from them is to ensure that if this law is not rolled back, if the judiciary is not restored back as of 2nd of November 2007, and if Musharraf does not step back, and if free and fair elections, as has been the topic of all over, is not ensured, then they must not, they must cease to support him.
That was Pakistani opposition leader Shahbaz Sharif. Earlier on Monday, General Musharraf claimed his crackdown would in fact lead to a speedier transition to democratic elections.
I am fully determined to execute the third stage of transition that I've been talking of. First stage being myself being in charge from 1999 to 2002. The second stage, my indirect control and overseeing from 2002 to 2007, and now a totally civilian president and fresh elections. This was the future that I saw.
Protests are continuing in Pakistan today. Deposed Chief Justice Iqbal Mohammed Chowdhury has called for mass defiance of Musharraf's crackdown. We'll have more on Pakistan and the broadcast. Back at the White House, President Bush emerged from his meeting with the Turkish Prime Minister with a pledge to provide intelligence over Kurdish movements in northern Iraq.
I asked the Secretary to call him. To convey this message. That we expect there to be elections as soon as possible.
En kısa zamanda seçim beklediğimizi ifade etmesini istedim.
And that the president should remove his military uniform.
Analysts say a full-scale Turkish invasion of northern Iraq is unlikely, but that President Bush has effectively given his tacit approval for limited Turkish bombings of Kurdish rebel positions there. The Senate Judiciary Committee is set to vote today on whether to send the nomination of Attorney General hopeful Michael Mukasey to the Senate floor. Mukasey's confirmation was in doubt last week over his refusal to declare waterboarding torture. But several Democratic senators have since claimed they'll support the nomination. On the eve of the vote, activists with the group World Can't Wait gathered in front of the Justice Department Monday to demonstrate an actual waterboarding. 26-year-old Iranian-American Mahboud Ebrahimzadeh volunteered as the mock terror suspect. Activists posing as interrogators poured several quarts of water into his mouth while a cloth was placed over his face. He was in visible pain as the waterboarding proceeded.
Easily the most terrifying experience I've ever had, I've ever felt. And although it's a controlled environment, water goes into your lungs, and you want to scream, and you can't, because you know as soon as you do, you're going to choke.
After the demonstration, anti-torture activist Clark Kissinger said waterboarding should only be seen as a form of torture.
Today we wanted to put on an actual demonstration of what waterboarding means when it's conducted by this government to people around the world. There seems to have been some confusion in the media about this. Some people like to refer to it as an enhanced interrogation technique. It is not an enhanced interrogation technique. It is torture.
Meanwhile, 24 former U.S. intelligence officials are urging Senate judiciary members not to back Mukasey's nomination until he declares his position on waterboarding. In a letter released Monday, the ex-officials write, quote, "We are aware that the president warned last week that it will be either Mukasey as our attorney general or no one, so be it." In Iraq, new figures show the number of displaced Iraqis has quadrupled under the so-called U.S. troop surge that began earlier this year. According to the Iraqi Red Crescent, 2.3 million people have been forced to flee their homes. 8 in 10 were residents of Baghdad. In Israel and the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has announced a long-planned U.S.-backed peace conference will be held the last week of this month. The Bush administration had previously refused to give the date for the meeting. Speaking in Ramallah, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said she hoped the talks would lead to a final peace deal.
This is indeed a historic time. It's a time of real opportunity, and I look forward to working with you over the next period of time so that we might prepare for a successful meeting at Annapolis, which should be the launching pad then for the negotiations that we have long sought. Negotiations that I sincerely hope, as Prime Minister Olmert said last night, could achieve their goal within the time remaining to the Bush administration.
U.S. and Israeli officials say they hope to resolve all remaining final status issues, but have been vague on the details. Israel's already rejected an Arab League peace offer that would provide full peace in return for a full withdrawal from the occupied territories. Back in the United States, new figures show a record number of prisoners are being held in U.S. immigration jails. The immigrant jail population has now topped 30,000, up from less than 20,000 last year. 4,000 are being held in California. The rise is attributed to growing decline to the policy of so-called catch and release. Private companies involved in holding and transferring prisoners are seeing record contracts. Deportations are also on the rise at 260,000 this year, up nearly 100,000 over 2 years ago. Immigrant rights advocates say the policy is leading to overcrowding and diminished medical care at the jails. In California, a contractor involved in the scandal that sent former Congressmember Randy Duke Cunningham to jail has been found guilty on all 13 counts in his corruption trial. Brent Wilkes received more than $80 million in government contracts after bribing Cunningham with hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash and gifts. Wilkes faces up to 20 years in prison. He still has to stand trial in a second case involving bribes to former CIA executive director Kyle Dusty Fogo. And Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island has introduced a Senate bill that would outlaw voter caging. Caging is an election suppression tactic that seeks to bar voters by challenging their eligibility to vote. Republicans have been accused of maintaining caging lists skewed towards people of color, predominantly African Americans. The Caging Prohibition Act would prohibit challenges to a person's eligibility based solely on returned mail or a caging list. The bill would also penalize anyone who challenges another's voter's eligibility without sufficient evidence. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. In a few minutes, we'll be going to Pakistan, but right now to Guatemala, where the centrist candidate Alvaro Colom has won the presidential election. This according to official election results released on Monday. In an upset victory, Colom beat the retired general Otto Perez Molina on Sunday's runoff election. Colom ran on an anti-poverty platform, won close to 53% of the vote. In his victory speech, Colom thanked his supporters.
We won against all odds, against everything, because truth was on our side. Because everyone's work and each one of you was efficient, because we didn't cheat or deceive. I said that we would win by between 4% and 7%, and we won by 5.2%.
General Perez Molina, who led in the polls until last week, ran on an anti-crime platform. The ex-head of Army Intelligence, he promised to expand the police force by half and to use the military to fight crime. He commanded troops in one of Guatemala's most violent areas and has been implicated in a number of political crimes. Perez Molina conceded defeat in a news conference after the results were announced.
We said we would respect the results given by the Supreme Electoral Tribunal and that we would respect the will of the Guatemalans expressed through the ballots, and that's what we are doing. We are present here.
To discuss the significance of the election and the task ahead for President-elect Alvaro Colom, we turn now to Guatemalan-American writer Francisco Goldman. His latest book is The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop? It implicates the defeated presidential candidate, General Perez Molina, in the 1998 murder of the beloved Guatemalan human rights activist Bishop Juan Harardi. Francisco Goldman joins us again, now from Houston, Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Francisco.
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. First, your response to the election results.
It's as a lot of my friends emailed me from Guatemala yesterday, Guatemalan democracy was saved. The country was on the verge of people thought that this General Perez Molina was going to be elected and possibly take them back to some equivalent of the hardline military rule of the 1980s. But the countryside in this vote defeated the city. And this is the first time in Guatemalan history, really, that the indigenous people in the highlands have really voted as a block and carried by surprise Colom to victory.
Now, talk about the significance of this. Isn't it the first time that the president did not win the city, but the countryside?
It's definitely the very first time that the Indian population, the Mayan Indian population, and the rural population have really decisively backed one candidate. And the capital, which, as you know, is more mixed racially and economically and et cetera, is quite separate and existent from its countryside. And in Guatemala City, the media, all the television stations, virtually all the newspapers, which are all owned by pro-business, right-wing type, you know, kinds of people, were heavily backing the general and, let's say, not quite allowing news that might harm the general's campaign to get into their media.
But we spoke last week before the election, and you gave quite a frightening profile of the candidate who's been defeated, the General Perez Molina. Can you briefly summarize who he is again?
General Perez Molina was during Guatemala's 36-year civil war, it had probably the army, which ruled and dominated throughout that war, gave Guatemala probably the worst human rights record in Latin America and among the worst in the world. 200,000 civilians were killed. A lot of the worst atrocities were committed by Guatemala's intelligence units, especially the G2 and the EMP, the presidential military staff. That's where the death squads came from. That's where the illegal detention centers, the torture centers came from. And General Perez Molina, a graduate of the School of the Americas and so forth, was a chief of both of those entities. And even in reporting in places like the New York Times, you know, very vicious crimes that he was responsible for have been reported on. But in the 1996 peace accords, the army, as the victor, insisted as a condition for peace, and acquiescent guerrillas agreed that there should be a blanket amnesty for all human rights crimes, which means that he really couldn't be prosecuted for a lot of those crimes. That was eventually breached when the UN declared crimes against humanity had occurred in Guatemala. There can be no amnesty for crimes against humanity, but impunity still reigns in Guatemala to a great degree, and the courts just haven't been strong enough to carry human rights trials forward. So what really became the issue, though, in the general's campaign were not his wartime crimes, but news beginning to filter out about his peacetime crimes, which included the allegations that are made in a part of my book about his involvement in the murder of Bishop Herardi, but also corruption charges and involvement in other crimes. These kinds of things began to bubble up on the fringes, but the pro Perez Molina media in Guatemala kept it out of the mainstream news down there, but it found its way into the population via other routes, let's say.
Once again, talk about the evidence you have for Perez Molina, the general, being implicated in the death of Bishop Juan Herardi, the man who had just released the Nunca Mas report, the report of hundreds of pages that indicated that it was the Guatemalan military with its paramilitaries who were responsible for the overwhelming number of deaths and disappearances in Guatemala through the 80s.
Well, the evidence that we had, Bishop Herardi, of course, with that report, presented the boldest challenge to the army's, you know, piñata of self-forgiveness, as a lot of people refer to as the amnesty, and as the great sort of intelligence guru, General Perez Molina, is sort of seen as almost a father figure among the officer class that would be vulnerable because if human rights prosecutions ever came forward. And the evidence we had is eventually, and the book I wrote, of course, chronicles the long legal struggle of these sort of secular young people in the Church Human Rights Office to discover who was responsible for the crime, and to eventually, a story of an extraordinary triumph, how they eventually managed to get three military men convicted for the murder, and investigations ordered into higher-ups, which could eventually include Perez Molina. The last government, which is a right-wing government, disbanded the office of the special prosecutor in the Herardi case to keep that case from going forward. But the key witness in the case told me that Otto Perez Molina had been involved when I spoke to him when he was in exile in Mexico. I later confirmed that with the head UN investigator, a former Spanish intelligence agent who ran the UN missions investigation in Guatemala, who had his own reasons for believing that, including an account which kind of challenged Perez Molina's alibi that he had been in Washington the week of the crime so that he couldn't have been responsible. But the UN knew that he had in fact had dinner with the chief of the UN mission 3 days after the murder, and he had warned, he said, don't pay attention to General Perez Molina's alibi that he had a diplomatic passport that says that he's in Washington. He's an intelligence chief. He uses multiple passports. And then after I brought this out in my book, Guatemalan newspaper reporters and the one honest, feisty newspaper in Guatemala, El Periódico, they took it further and discovered that, yes, indeed, he had seven passports registered under his name, just as that Spaniard had predicted. And also, this reporter discovered that witness had told the UN investigator about Perez Molina's involvement in the murder 2 days after it occurred during their first interrogation.
Will there be trials of any of those, perhaps even Perez Molina, involved in not only the death, the murder of Bishop Herardi, but so many others? 200,000 people died during that time.
Colom has said in his declarations that really the most important issue to him is ending impunity in Guatemala and strengthening the judicial system. When I spoke to him on the phone a few months ago, he told me that if he became president, he was going to reopen the office of the special prosecutor in the Harardi case. So I really expect him to do that. And it's really important to mention that for the first time in its history, the United Nations has appointed a commission in Guatemala. It's called CSIGS. It's a special commission to go after these military intelligence units that General Perez Molina headed. It's a commission to go. It's the Guatemalan Commission Against Impunity, and they're charged with going after clandestine security groups and their links to organized crime, which is what this story is all about. And the UN Secretary General has appointed a Spanish judge who can now assemble a team of foreign and national prosecutors to develop cases against clandestine security forces in Guatemala. If General Perez Molina had become president, you would have had the bizarre scenario of CSIGS investigating him and his cronies for these kinds of crimes. Now, with President Colom, there's going to be a civilian president who can work hand in hand with this UN commission to finally take impunity on in Guatemala. So I think it's going to be, I hate to use the word hopeful in a country that has suffered as much as Guatemala, but this is really the most hopeful scenario I've seen there in decades.
We're talking to Francisco Goldman, and we're going to come back to him. He wrote the book, The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop? It's just out. I want to ask about U.S. involvement in a number of these killings, U.S. backing the Guatemalan military and military intelligence, and also the role of the School of the Americas. And the latest news that was just breaking this past week of Perez Molina being linked to narco-traffickers coming out in the Guatemalan paper El Periódico. But we'll talk about that with him in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be going to Pakistan to find out the latest there in what some have called a coup by the general and president, Musharraf. But we're staying in Guatemala right now with Francisco Goldman, who is the acclaimed Guatemalan-American novelist who has written a nonfiction work called The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop, about the murder of Bishop Juan Harardi, who had just released a human rights report in 1998. 2 days later, he was killed. That report shook the country, naming names, people involved in the killings of, well, 200,000 people died in the 1980s in Guatemala. Can you talk about the vice president, Francisco Goldman? You're speaking to us right now from Houston. The vice president, a well-known cardiologist in Houston,
well, he was kind of, I think, they call him Dr. Corazon. He gave a lot of intellectual and moral credibility to Colom's campaign. He's kind of a revered figure in Guatemala. And I thought that a lot of his, the few interviews I saw with him during the campaign were kind of prescient. He was just so eloquent in his, he was so shocked and stunned. He said, how can Guatemala, after what this country has been through, even be considering turning power back to the military, to the very same people that plunged this country into such violence and held it there for so many decades? And I think that I think that the countryside, and especially the message of this election, was that the people in the countryside said, no, yes, we remember what the military did in this country, and we're not going to forget it, and we don't care what it says in the city and what the polls say and what the urban newspapers and TV stations are saying. We remember, and we're not going to let it happen again. And I think I received some extraordinary emails, and even just to give an indication of how the news got out. Even our interview that we did last week on Democracy Now!, that began to circulate on the internet, where Amy, you and I spoke about the charges against Bishop Gerardi, and I got an email telling me that in Santiago Atitlan and other towns, young Catholics had downloaded that interview from the internet, the interview in which we spoke about the charges against Perez Molina in the Gerardi case, translated it, and stood outside the cemetery on the Day of the Dead with big photocopied piles of the transcript of the interview, handing it out to people, because the Guatemalan media wouldn't report it, so people took it into their own hands to get the truth out.
We're talking to Francisco Goldman. You also said at the end of that interview last week, Francisco Goldman, that it was just breaking in a Guatemalan newspaper, links between Perez Molina, the defeated presidential candidate now, and narco-traffickers. Right. What is that about?
Well, you know, when you really talk about that whole world of military intelligence and the reason they've held on to power in Guatemala since the years of the war, right? Because during the war, the CIA empowered them essentially to be the Cold War front line, the clandestine groups that would really take the war, you know, to opposition figures, and that's the death squads and so forth. And, you know, now why in peacetime, despite the fact that the peace accords say that intelligence should be in the hands of civilians, why do they so desperately hold on to power? The answer to that lies in the fact that even the DEA says that up to 70% of the cocaine that reaches the United States comes through Guatemala. And the reason that, you know, the reason that happens is because of this clandestine world of military intelligence power. They basically went from working for the CIA to working for the narco cartels, essentially. And so everybody in this world is kind of implicated. That's what power is about, connections to organized crime, to mafias. And Perez Molina comes out of that world, and there's been lots of stories and lots of strange incidents linking him to that. And so some young reporters who had been investigating his ties to narco traffickers found some evidence. I haven't seen the story. They wanted to publish it. The newspaper decided not to publish it. No other Guatemalan paper would publish it. They began to get death threats. The newspaper they worked for began to get threats, and they went to the Human Rights Commission to denounce what was happening to them, and the story started to get out in wire services. And that was yet one more allegation against Perez Molina to surface in the last days of the crime. As these allegations against Perez Molina began to surface in the last weeks of the election, it was really interesting. He suddenly went very quiet, and he ducked his last few debates. He didn't want to answer questions about the Gerardi case or about any of the other allegations that were beginning to come out against him. And that might be yet another thing that cost him the election.
Francisco Goldman, the issue of the U.S. support for the death squads in Guatemala through the 1980s.
Right.
The U.N. report on the killings did not talk about the United States. Did Nunca Mas, did Juan Gerardi's report? And what is that as we move into this month, November, where there is the annual protest at the School of the Americas outside of Fort Benning, now has a new name, where thousands of people go to protest?
Well, you know, the highest man convicted in the Gerardi case, Colonel Lima Estrada, graduate of the School of the Americas. General Perez Molina, a graduate of the School of Americas, also known to have been on the CIA payroll during the war years. This is the early on in the 60s when they decided that they were going to turn Guatemala into kind of a frontline, you know, Cold War proxy state. They empowered these military intelligence units to guard U.S. interests, and they became a kind of Frankenstein monster that got away from U.S. control and became what they are today. And their roots are directly in that kind of U.S. support that goes all the way back to the 1960s and the immediate aftermath of the 1954 coup. It's important to remember that even now with Colom, this is the first time that Guatemala had, even though he's left of center, this is the first time Guatemala's had a left-leaning leader since 1954 when the U.S. CIA-backed coup deposed Jacobo Arbenz as president of Guatemala.
Talking about that parallel, if there is one, the new president, Colom, says his first meeting will be with leaders from the Mayan community and that he would implement the little-used provision in 1996 peace accord, allowing the government to buy property to redistribute to landless farmers, this according to Hector Tobar in the Los Angeles Times. What about the significance of this? Of course, in 1954, when Arbenz was overthrown, it was done by the United States, with the support of United Fruit Company, or rather, to support the United Fruit Company.
Right. Well, I don't think we're going to see from Colom nearly as I don't think the political space is there for him to conduct the kind of land reform the Arbenz government did, leading up to the 1954 coup. But Colom, that's where his support is. He used to run FONAPAS, which was an institute that was responsible for helping Indians and rural people to gain possession of land, even in, the Guatemala, the repressive Guatemala of the recent past. That's why one of the reasons he had so much support in the highlands. And I think he's very sincere in his desire to do everything he can to get more land into the hands of Guatemala's, Guatemala has probably one of the most unequal land distribution rates in the hemisphere. It easily does. And I think that he's going to hopefully push the envelope as far as he can in that respect. And he certainly owes the Mayan population in Guatemala everything. They gave him his presidency. So I would expect that he's going to feel a great obligation to give as much back as he can, and this is one way to do it.
Francisco Goldman, I want to thank you for being with us. Acclaimed Guatemalan American novelist, now has written his first nonfiction book. It's called The Art of Political Murder: Who Killed the Bishop? Francisco Goldman speaking to us from Houston, where the new vice president of Guatemala, the well-known cardiologist Dr. Espada, now the vice president of Guatemala, has run his practice. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn to Pakistan. It's been 3 days since the general, Pervez Musharraf, imposed a state of emergency. The crackdown continues. Thousands of lawyers, human rights activists, journalists were tear-gassed, beaten, arrested Monday for protesting what they describe as nothing short of martial law. Over 48 hours after the crisis erupted, President Bush made his first public comments Monday following a White House meeting with the Turkish Prime Minister. He did not mention cuts in aid to Pakistan, but urged General Pervez Musharraf to hold elections. Pakistan's received over $10.5 billion in U.S. aid since September 11, 2001, three-quarters of which goes to the military, according to figures from the D.C.-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. This is an excerpt of President Bush's statement.
I asked the secretary to call him to convey this message that we expect there to be elections as soon as possible, and that the president should remove his military uniform. Previous to his decision, we'd made it clear that these emergency measures were you know, would undermine democracy.
Kararından önce bu acil önlemlerin demokrasinin altına uyacağını çok net bir şekilde ifade etmiştik.
Having said that, I did remind the Prime Minister that President Musharraf has been a strong fighter against extremists and radicals.
Responding to reporters' questions Monday, President Bush again reiterated the need to continue supporting General Musharraf, given his role in the so-called war on terror.
As I said earlier in my statement, that we made it clear to the President that we would hope he wouldn't have declared the emergency powers he declared. Now that he's made that decision, our hope now is that he hurry back to elections. And at the same time, we want to continue working with him to fight these terrorists and extremists who not only have tried to kill him, but who use parts of his country from which to launch attacks into Afghanistan and or are plotting attacks on America.
Earlier on Monday, General Musharraf also spoke out from Islamabad in an address on state-run television. The general emphasized his proclamation of emergency was designed to, quote, ensure the implementation of the transition to civilian rule and democratic elections in Pakistan.
I am fully determined to execute the third stage of transition that I've been talking of. First stage being myself being in charge from 1999 to 2002. The second stage, my indirect control and overseeing from 2002 to 2007, and now a totally civilian president and fresh elections. I am determined to execute this third stage of transition fully, and I am determined to remove my uniform. Once we correct these pillars, the judiciary and the executive and the parliament, legislative, I can assure you there will be harmony. There will be harmony. Confidence will come back into government, into law enforcement agencies, and Pakistan will start moving again on the same track as we were moving.
That was Pakistani leader General Pervez Musharraf. In a separate statement Monday, the previous Prime Minister, Shaukat Aziz, also reversed his earlier position that general elections could be delayed by a year. He asserted Monday they could take place within 3 months as scheduled. Back in the White House, the crisis in Pakistan was the main focus of Monday's press briefing. This is an excerpt of the briefing with White House Press Secretary Dana Perino. It begins with Perino's response to a question about how the U.S. plans to respond to General Musharraf's undemocratic moves.
Well, these are things that we're going to have to consider. Obviously, having a we want to prevent terrorists from having a safe haven in Pakistan, and that's what President Musharraf has been helping us to do. And that has to continue. As Secretary Gates said, we don't want to take any measures that would undermine our efforts there. But what we'd like to see is an immediate return back to the path to democracy that they were well on their way towards achieving.
What he's doing is against the terrorists, that is necessary to preserve stability there against terrorists.
We do not believe that any extra constitutional means were necessary in order to help prevent terrorism in the region. And that's why we are deeply disappointed with the actions, and we asked him to not do it.
Is it ever reasonable to restrict constitutional freedoms in the name of fighting terrorism?
In our opinion, no.
Would you consider restricting the aid to the war on terrorism?
Restricting what?
Restricting aid to the war on terrorism to ensure that it doesn't... In other words, would you consider being so restrictive of whatever aid you decide to give to Pakistan in the future once you've done this?
Again, you're asking me a hypothetical question about an outcome of a review that is ongoing, so I'm not going to answer the question right now, because I don't know. I don't want to prejudge it.
Thank you. Dana, 6 years and $11 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money to Pakistan, and today Pakistan has become a haven for terrorism. You think President believes really that this money is worth and...
Well, we know one thing for sure, which is that Pakistani officials have certainly helped us find individuals like terrorists like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. That's how we were able to get him and actually help prevent another terrorist attack. So there has been help. We cannot lose sight of that.
And you think President still calls President Bush still calls General Musharraf president, or he will change to General Musharraf now because he has
the president has called on President Musharraf to take off the uniform.
That's the White House press person, Dana Perino, answering questions from reporters. We now go to Pakistan for the latest. We're joined on the phone from Lahore by freelance British journalist Farzana Fiaz. She's been reporting from Pakistan for the Associated Press and BBC since March. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Farzana.
Thank you very much.
First, can you tell us what the latest is in the streets of Lahore?
On the streets of Lahore, it's been relatively quiet compared to yesterday. The protests that started yesterday have been continuing. However, they've been quieter today. There has been a large police presence, and I know that a few more lawyers have been arrested today in Lahore. In Islamabad today, news is that the Chief Justice, or rather the ousted Chief Justice Iftikhar Mohammed Chowdhury, gave an address via mobile phone, since he's under house arrest, urging Pakistanis to rise up against the state of emergency that President Musharraf has instigated.
Can you talk, now that you've just heard some of the U.S. officials' comments from President Bush to Dana Perino, about the, well, let's just say, lackluster response or criticism to what the general has done? Can you talk about U.S. support for General Musharraf over these years and the muted response to the state of emergency from the U.S. government?
Well, I don't think it's any secret. Most people are aware that the U.S. and the U.K. by association have had a hand in these recent talks that have taken place between Benazir Bhutto, whom is the desired candidate for the next prime minister. The influence that the U.S. has been, I think, in a way that this latest move by Musharraf is, in a way, slightly in defiance of President Bush. He's obviously not taking his advice to the letter, otherwise he would not have declared this state of emergency. I think it's more a case of Musharraf wanting to cling on to power at all costs by any means necessary. And if that means defying the advice of President Bush, who many see as the real leader in Pakistan, the real person in charge, and the government being merely the middle management, I think that's a sign that Musharraf is that desperate to cling on to power.
Can you talk about the statements of the fired Chief Justice right now and his significance as he declares this new government, new court, illegal, immoral?
Sorry, what was the question?
Can you talk about his comments, Chowdhury's comments?
It runs in parallel to the way that the Chief Justice, or the ousted Chief Justice, Iftikhar Chowdhury, has been operating this last year. He is really the key figure in this this discussion on democracy in Pakistan. He really has been the only person, the only public figure who stood up to Musharraf and demanded democratic rights within Pakistan for Pakistani people. So it's not surprising from that perspective that Iftikhar Chowdhury is requesting and urging Pakistanis, ordinary Pakistani people, to rise up against the president.
His statements are very strong, encouraging the people to rise up and restore the Constitution, saying the Constitution has been ripped to shreds by General Musharraf, adding, now is a time for sacrifice, and the significance of hundreds of lawyers taking to the streets.
Well, the lawyers, again, like the ousted Chief Justice, have been major players in this year, especially in their fight for democracy. They have been the ones who stood behind the Chief Justice when he was ousted by President Musharraf back in March, and they were the ones that supported him all the way back into office. So, again, it's not a surprise that the lawyers are the force at the forefront, alongside the journalists, the NGO workers, and the human rights activists.
Are there more protests expected now on the streets of Lahore, Islamabad, other places?
Well, since the state of emergency was instigated on Saturday, the police have really clamped down very hard on any form of protest. Something as innocuous or as innocent-sounding as a group of human rights activists meeting on Sunday, and if all of those can get rounded up and thrown into jail, then really anything is possible. And the police here, let's not forget, are quite brutal and very unforgiving. They will not stop at, you know, I don't think they realize the image that's coming across of them and of Pakistan as a civil society.
And the media, much of it being closed down, how people are getting their information, some national media not being allowed to broadcast in Pakistan, but broadcasting internationally, and the journalists on the streets being beat up.
Absolutely. We have this strange phenomenon, this strange situation where we have the cameramen and reporters of the various Pakistani channels such as Geo and Door News out on the streets filming what's going on in Pakistan, but being unable to broadcast within the country. So at the moment, the only news that you'll see on the television is the state-run PTV. Normal channels that you can see, the international channels such as CNN, the BBC, Al Jazeera, and others, Sky News, for example, nowhere to be seen. There's the only other source of information, the press, the printed press at the moment has been relatively untouched. However, there are increasing rumors that they too are being raided. Some offices have been raided. There was a report that the offices of Jung newspaper in Karachi were raided, and that the police are now taking a very, very active role in closely watching what comes out in the press.
Well, Farzana Faz, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a freelance journalist based in Lahore, Pakistan. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Senate Judiciary Committee prepares to vote today on the nomination of retired Judge Michael Mukasey to be Attorney General, the issue of waterboarding and torture is at the top of the agenda. Mukasey has refused to condemn waterboarding as a form of torture, yet his approval by the Judiciary Committee seems all but assured after two Democrats on the panel said they will support him. That's Schumer and Feinstein. While the practice of waterboarding is getting mainstream coverage, another controversial Bush administration tactic is also being thrust into the mainstream spotlight: Extraordinary Rendition, a new Hollywood movie starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Reese Witherspoon, is called Rendition, centers around the story of an Egyptian U.S. resident who's captured by U.S. agents at a U.S. airport, flown to a North African country to be tortured. Then tonight, PBS's Frontline World program is featuring a new documentary called Extraordinary Rendition. It's an international investigation by the award-winning journalist Stephen Gray, who first tracked the CIA's rendition flights in 2004. His book is called Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. The documentary features interviews with victims of extraordinary rendition speaking for the first time on U.S. television. This is an excerpt of Stephen Gray's investigation.
For years, I pursued the story of Bishr al-Rawi, an Iraqi-born British resident who once acted as a messenger between an al-Qaeda suspect in London and British intelligence. In 2002, while he was on a business trip to Gambia in Africa, the CIA had al-Rawi and several colleagues arrested. He says he was betrayed by his British handlers, who turned him over to the Americans. Al-Rawi now finds it painful to recall his treatment by the CIA.
He took me into a room. They sort of stripped me, cut off my clothes, and, you know, they just did their stuff, which I don't feel comfortable or necessary to go through. But it's not very pleasant, not very nice, and very, very humiliating, very intrusive.
Al-Rawi was bound, gagged, and hooded by the Americans. They drugged him with a suppository, dressed him in a diaper and a jumpsuit, and put him on a plane. He was tied down in the same way as the US military secure enemy combatants captured on the battlefield.
I was restrained from all, you know, feet, torso, chest. Of course, I can't see anything. Like, you know, I can't see, I can't hear. You know, my ears are blocked. I was in a lot of pain, and I was sort of counting the seconds. Actually, just counting 1 second, 2 seconds, just like that, really. Just hoping that it's going to be over soon. It's going to be over soon. And then the aircraft landed. Now they're going to take us out of the aircraft. Now. They didn't.
An excerpt of the Frontline World Investigation into Extraordinary Rendition airing tonight, 9 Eastern Time, on PBS stations around the country. Stephen Gray, the award-winning investigative journalist who conducted the investigation, author of Ghost Plane, joining us now from San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what happened to Bashar Alrawi, the man who was just speaking now in that excerpt?
Yeah, he became a ghost prisoner. He disappeared. He was grabbed in the Gambia in West Africa with another prisoner, Jamil Albana, who was on a—they were both on a business trip. And the British had tipped off the Americans they were turning up, even though Bishop was actually—had been working with British intelligence. And they were put on this same Gulfstream jet we've seen a lot in rendition operations, operated from North Carolina by a company called Aero Contractors, a CIA front company, and sent in this plane to a first stopping in Egypt and then on to Afghanistan. He's one of the first witnesses to come out of a CIA dark site, a black site, one of the first to exist, called the Dark Prison. And he describes this incredible experience of being locked up day after day, completely on his own, not even questioned, and with music bombarding him, the music of madmen, he says, just bombarding him day after day. He said he couldn't even see the end of his nose. It was that dark. And he was just left there for days on end. It was a form of psychological torture. I mean, eventually he was sent to Bagram, put in a cage in Bagram, beaten up there, he says, and then sent to Guantanamo Bay, where he remained for 4 years. He's just been released without any charge at all.
Stephen Gray, can you talk about Abu Omar, who you went in secret to Egypt to interview, the Sheikh kidnapped off the streets of Milan?
Yes. I mean, as you know, I've been following this story for a long time, all these renditions, and you sort of think it's over, but then you realize there's all these voices out there, the people who are ghost prisoners are becoming real, who are now able to tell their stories, and the story just gets more powerful. And we're able to find the victim of probably one of the most notorious renditions. This is a man, as you say, picked off the streets in Milan, sent to Cairo, Egypt. Now, I've spoken previously to a lot of people in the FBI and the CIA who told me about the torture inflicted on people sent there by the CIA to Cairo. But here's the man describing it for himself. And he was abused in the most appalling way. I mean, he was beaten. Given electric shock treatments on his genitals. He was then raped. They tried to rape him. But this wasn't just one day. It went on for 13 months in prison. And he's not been charged. He was never charged, and he was finally released. And he also leaves behind dozens of people that he says are still in Egyptian jail. And they all wear a white uniform. The uniform says interrogation on it. And that means they haven't been charged with anything. They are still there, held in secret, without access to any lawyers, and they're held indefinitely. And they're all people who've been sent there by the CIA and the rendition program.
The Italian court, where the more than 24 CIA agents were being tried in absentia, has continued the suspension of that trial till the top court rules on it. How significant is this trial in absentia of CIA agents for the kidnapping of Abu Omar?
Well, you know, in the absence of a real congressional investigation into this whole program, the Italian court is the most comprehensive look at a case of rendition, and it's going to expose all manner of parts of the CIA's operations. Italian justice takes a long time. Their cases tend to drag on. And the Italian Supreme Court, their constitutional court, is going to rule about whether state secrets are being revealed in this case. But the likelihood is it'll go ahead because the Italian judiciary is very independent. And it's going to show how the CIA officers worked in Milan. It's going to show how the Italian police were actually investigating Abu Omar. They wanted to bring him into trial in a normal courtroom, but in fact, he was just disappeared. His words are he was disappeared from history, and also the cooperation secretly of some Italian military intelligence officers who worked secretly with the CIA, essentially, according to the Italian police locally, betrayed them by snatching him away and destroying a normal civilian police investigation that would have actually potentially brought him to trial in a very normal way.
Stephen Gray, the involvement of the Kenyan government in these kidnapping flights, these so-called extraordinary rendition flights?
Yes, I wanted to know if this rendition was continuing, you know, despite all the controversy and these court cases going on in Europe. And what I found was that it's still happening, and it's getting worse. In the Horn of Africa this year, more than 90 people were picked up as they fled fighting in Somalia. And they were accused of being international terrorists, and among them were at least 10 women and 11 children. They were put on flights, secret flights, out of Kenya through Somalia, and then ended up in a secret prison in Ethiopia. And it was there that they were questioned by American agents. Now, things are changing slightly. The rendition program is evolving, and you're seeing other countries being used to transport and hold these prisoners. But ultimately, the objective is the same, which is that they were brought to a place where they could be questioned by the U.S. And it was quite striking you had here, not the arrest of a wanted terrorist, but the arrest of his wife and children. And you know, you wonder what the purpose of that was, because, again, they were never accused of any crime. They were questioned for their intelligence value, and that interrogation took place for months and months and months without any access to a lawyer, even the Red Cross, or any information given to these prisoners.
Stephen Gray, what are your thoughts on Michael Mukasey, the Attorney General nominee, who looks like he'll be approved by the Senate committee, then gone on to the Senate, full Senate, with Democrats joining with Republicans and approving him, when he says if waterboarding is torture, then it's unconstitutional, but he has not said whether it's torture?
Yeah, I mean, I'll sort of duck the political questions. I'm a reporter, but it's interesting that the Senate has not dealt with the issue of rendition. I mean, you have something there which is pretty clearly illegal, given that there is a very strong U.S. law that says you can't send people to be tortured. And the time has come when one CIA officer after another, in authority, and including in our program, Tyler Drumella, former head of operations in Europe, saying very clearly, we knowingly sent people to places where they would be tortured. And it's strange that the Judiciary Committee, which is there to investigate these things, has not examined that issue. And I think on waterboarding, I, like many journalists, should issue a correction, an apology, really, because we all reported waterboarding as a simulated drowning. And I think you follow the story. It's now very clear from those who did it. This is actual drowning. And it's deeply abhorrent to those who watch it, who are there in the room, never mind for the person being tortured, because it actually involves a physical process of drowning. Controlled form of death is what was the phrase used by one of those who's used it very frequently, Malcolm Nance, who wrote a piece recently in the Small Wars Journal. And it's abhorrent for those who watch it. And if the test in law is something that shocks the conscience, then and that is torture. It's very clear that anyone who's actually taken part in this process, be it actually done it, watched it, or being the victim of it, that this is something that shocks the conscience and therefore is torture.
Have people died from waterboarding?
I'm not aware of people dying in the CIA program. They certainly have died in the past, and it's a process of dying. You intervene at the last minute to rescue somebody. But, you know, one thing that has been covered over is that I recently saw George Tenet, the former director, being interviewed when he said no one had died under CIA interrogation. That isn't true. There were prisoners. I followed the case of a prisoner who died in Iraq, in a special part of Abu Ghraib. He died. He was asphyxiated. It was a homicide, and he died while in the CIA's hands. And there was a prisoner in a CIA black site in Afghanistan in the salt pit.
Stephen Gray, we're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you very much for being with us. The documentary that he has done on Extraordinary Rendition airs tonight, Frontline, at 9 p.m. On PBS. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abu-Qudus, Aaron Mate, Nicole Salazar, Steve Martinez, Jeffrey Hagerman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.